אשיך השם, השם שמע בקולי, תהיין אוזנך קשובה לכל תחנונה. Hashem, I heard, I heard a new song, the song of the day, of the morning to come. Hashem, I heard, I heard a new song, the song of the day, of the morning to come. Hashem, I can't wait for the day, can't wait for the morning to come. Hashem, I can't wait for the day, can't wait for that morning to come. Hashem, I can't wait for the day, can't wait for that morning to come. Hashem, I can't wait, can't wait for that day, can't wait for that morning to come.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for coming. Afreilich and Chanukah, a good chodesh. First of all, I would like to announce a new shiur that we will begin Be'ezras Hashem next week, Wednesday, and all Wednesdays at 8 o'clock. The name of the class is You Versus Yourself, and subtitle, A Hasidic Approach to the Human Condition. This is going to be, Be'ezras Hashem, a very, very, very fascinating class, dealing with the issues of everyday life and the difficulties and struggles of the fluctuations within ourselves, where sometimes we feel so holy and so godly, sometimes we feel so lowly. And the point of the class is to get a better understanding of our inner dynamics that make up our psyche, and so that we're far better equipped to deal with the challenges and difficulties in life. That class will not be available on CDs, so best way to hear the class is actually to come over here to Mayan Yisroel at 8 o'clock on Wednesdays, and our website will carry the class as well. So again, beginning next week, Wednesday at 8 o'clock, and of course, sponsorships are always welcome. They help us out a lot. In regards to this week, we have, Baruch Hashem, a few sponsors, special sponsors, and I would like to announce them now. First, we have the shiur and the CD this week was sponsored by Rabbi and Mrs. Munitz, and this is in honor of Mrs. Munitz's father, whose yahrzeit is going to be Friday, Gimel Tevis, Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef ben Harav Avrom Doiv. May his neshama have a very great aliyah to the greatest of heights. May he send a lot of brachas down to your family, to your children and grandchildren, and lots of good, to the ultimate aliyah of the neshama returning here to a body by the coming of Mashiach. The other sponsor this week is David Wittenberg, and this is in honor of his wife Chani's birthday. May Hashem give you a shnas bracha natzlacha and many, many, many years of happiness together, the May of the Yesrim till 120 and beyond, and nachas from the children, and only, and health and wealth, and all the goodies that Hashem can give. May it all materialize in a revealed and happy way in your life. The next sponsor this week, sponsorship for this year, was Yehuda Abram Choeb from Ariel Market. So Baruch Hashem, Ariel Market is always helping us out at our place. We want to thank him very much for that and for this special sponsorship. He sponsored it in honor and neschus for his family. May Hashem bring a lot of blessings to him and to his entire mishpacha. Thank you. This week's parsha is Parshas Vayigash. And in Parshas Vayigash, we read about the transition of the Jewish people from the land of Israel as they went down into exile to the land of Mitzrayim. Yaakov and his family traveled to Mitzrayim. Now the Pasuk tells us, the verses in the Parsha describe who went down to Mitzrayim. And it says that the family, the size of the family that went down, that there were 70 people that went down to Egypt. It mentions the number 70 quite a few times in the Torah in regards to the size of the Jewish people in Devarim. There's a pasuk b'shivim nefesh yardu avisecha Mitzrayim. With 70 souls, we say it in the Agada on Pesach, with 70 souls, 70 members, your family, your forefathers went down to Egypt, and the like. This week, in our parsha too, Perek Memvav, Pasuk Chav Zayin, Kol HaNefesh LeBeis Yaakov, all the souls to the family of Yaakov, Abba Mitzrayim, that came to Mitzrayim, Shivim were 70. Torah goes as far as to enumerate exactly who they were, the 70 members of the family who went down to Mitzrayim. When we do the count, you reach the number 66. And 66 people who went down to Mitzrayim. How do we make up 70? So there is another, when we add Yosef and his two sons that were already in Mitzrayim, Yosef and Asher and Ephraim, so now we have 69. But there is still one missing. And the Pasuk, the verse, it doesn't say who is that 70th one that completes the number of people that went down to Egypt. So we need to know who is this? Who is the 70th one? So the commentators and sages are perplexed with this, and they offer. Now the Medrash, for instance, gives three answers, the Medrash Rabbah, of who is the missing one that completes the 70. The first opinion is that it's Yaakov. This is the opinion of the Ibn Ezra. This is also the Rashbam, the Daz Akenim, Mibala Tosfis, the Abarbanel, and the Ralbag, and the Arachayim. Then there is another opinion in the Medrash, where it says that it's Hashem is the one who joined the Jewish people when they went down to Egypt. As the Pasuk says, Onoichi Eidet Imcha Mitzrayim. God Himself says, I will go down with you to Egypt. So Hashem joined the Jewish people as the 70th Jew to come down to Mitzrayim. And Hashem completed with them to be the 70th one. This opinion originates in Pirkei de Rebbe Eliezer. And then there is another opinion. There is, it's the Talmud, the Gemara. The Gemara in Tractate Baba Basra, Daf Kufchav Gimel, page 123, on the second side, Daf Amid Beis. Rashi is also of this opinion. Also the Targum Yonason Ben Uziel in our parasha, that the 70th one was a tiny little baby that was born at the threshold, at the border between the Chomos, Bein HaChomos, as the family was entering into Egypt, as they were passing through the walls of Mitzrayim, a mazel tov to the family of Levi. Levi's wife gave birth to a little girl. And that little girl was Yocheved, the mother of Moshe Rabbeinu. And she is the one that completes the missing Jew. She is the 70th Jew. her name is not mentioned amongst the 70 who came down to Mitzrayim because she's different and unlike the others. The others descended to Egypt. They first lived in the land of Canaan, and then they were relocated down to Mitzrayim. She was born into the exile, as they were walking into the Golus, as they were walking into the exile. So we need to understand the significance of this, and the meaning of this dispute and of the argument, because we see clearly that the Torah is very, very strongly emphasizing that the Jewish people, that there needed to be 70 Jews going to Mitzrayim. Because or else, you know, what difference? If it happens to be 70, the Torah could have just said, these are the people who went down. If we find that the number is emphasized a few times in the Torah that it was 70 people, there's a sign that there is a certain significance and an importance of why there needed to be 70. And aside from that, not only that there needed to be 70, but that the 70th one should be apart and different than the others. That there is 69, and then there is a missing one, someone who is mashlim, someone who completes the number. That is not, that is apart and separate from all the others, but is being added on to be the 70th one. So we need to understand, why is that? What is the meaning of there is 69, and there is a mysterious one, the last one? Now, who is that last one? So we have the different opinions, but the difference of opinions are quite extreme in what they hold. According to the one opinion, is that that the one who is added and included is Yaakov, which means we are completing the number to be 70 with the greatest of them all, with a power, with a soul that is stronger than all the other souls. I understand Yaakov was a far greater neshama and a greater power than his children. So we're this added 70th, which is apart and hidden and not clearly stated, is a strength and a being that is stronger than the others. Especially if we go according to the opinion that Hashem is the one who joins them. God is definitely surpasses all the souls and higher and above all the neshamas. So the completion of the number is with a power infinitely greater than the other 69. However, according to the Rashi's explanation and the Talmud, that it's Yocheved that is being the one who is being mashlem, is completing this number. So then it's the weakest one. It's a little baby just born, which her spiritual stature is lower than all the others that came down to Mitzrayim. It's also a woman, a girl that was born. Yocheved, which is a newborn. See, the other women, Dina and Serach, lived amongst, together with Yaakov. They lived in the land of Israel. So therefore, they had already had time. They were mature at this time. They've already developed themselves and breathed the light of holiness in the holy environment that they lived before. Yocheved is just born. She doesn't have any of her own merit. She hasn't developed herself. And she did not have even the advantage of living in the Holy Land. She is born immediately into the Golus. So she's very weak. So here we have the extremity of the strongest of the strong, the mightiest, whether it's Yaakov, or even beyond, whether it's God, or that it is Yocheved, that is the last contributing power that is necessary to take the Jewish people into the exile. So we need to gain an understanding into this. Another interesting thing is that when the Torah gives the number of how many Jews were there, it summarizes, and it says, before it gives the number 70, it says there are 66, aside from Yosef and his two sons. And it's interesting that the Torah uses feminine terminology. It says, Shishim Vashesh. Shesh is the Lashon Nekeva. It's a feminine way of saying six. The masculine way of saying six is Shisha. Now, the Torah primarily speaks B'lashon Zachar in masculine terms, unless it's dealing directly with women, but or with a feminine concept. But when the Torah is dealing with a masculine concept, it's using masculine terms, especially over here, when most of the members of the family that were being counted were men. Nevertheless, the Torah uses a feminine term. And that is because it seems like what the Torah is saying, that the 70 members that were coming down to Egypt
were 70 women and not men. Meaning, even though it was men, but it was men that were coming as women to Egypt, meaning with a feminine element, not that much with their masculine element. So we need to understand what is that, why is it that way? So to understand this, we need to gain a deeper insight into the entire, into the very meaning of the exile itself, into the Golus. Golus Mitzrayim, the first exile, which is kind of astonishing, that the Jewish people became a nation when they were in exile. And that's strange, because we would think to develop a people and to create a strong foundation, the nation should have been born in a place, in an environment conducive for to develop a nation. Instead, God developed us as a nation, as it says, goy bekerev goy, a nation in the bowels of another nation, in the midst of another nation, and in a state of darkness and in a state of exile. So why is it that the Jewish people were forged and emerged as a people in such an extreme and difficult environment? So it is known that the Golus of Mitzrayim was a preparation for Matan Torah. The exile, the Egyptian exile, was a preparation that prepared and paved the way for the giving of the Torah. And that was the whole purpose of the exile. It was there, so in order that after that, the Torah can be given to the world. And Golus Mitzrayim, as a preparation for Matan Torah, is twofold. Now, there's two elements in how the Egyptian exile prepared the world for the giving of the Torah. One is pertaining to the world, and the other one is pertaining to the Jewish people. One of these reasons. I mean, there's something that Egyptian exile was a contributing factor in which prepared the rest of the world for the giving of the Torah. And that is because the giving of the Torah is not only a gift to the Jewish people. It's not something that was just given to us so that we can live a higher life, a life attached and connected to Hashem. But rather, the giving of the Torah was meant for all of creation. It radically changed the entire universe and all of existence. And that is because in the onset of creation, the creation is in a state, or at least the physical, the material world, is in a state of disconnect from God. There is a barrier. There is a great wall of darkness, a wall of klipa, a wall of shell that is blocking and obscuring and hiding God from the creations, and creating sort of a state of affairs where the creation doesn't acknowledge and doesn't feel naturally, the physical doesn't naturally acknowledge, recognize the Creator, and therefore it feels separated and disconnected. And that is why there can be evil and all the unholiness that is within the world. That is because of the state of disconnect that the world is in. The giving of the Torah was a breaching and breaking that wall, is what enabled the process of sublimation and elevation of creation to begin. Because as a result of the divine, the great godly revelation of Har Sinai, Vayered Hashem al Har Sinai, and then the subsequent performance of mitzvahs in the world, enables or begins the process of elevation and rectification of the world, which means we're enabling the physical creation to host, to first to surrender, then to host, and to express divinity. As when we do a mitzvah in the world, we are bringing God Himself to be expressed in the world. And as a result of the accumulation of 3.5 millennia of Torah study and mitzvah observance of the Jewish people throughout the world, the world will be in a state glowing with godly light in the Messianic era in the time of Mashiach. But so that's the accomplishment of Torah, of how the Torah affects Matan Torah, revolutionized and radically changed the creation forever and ever. In order for that to happen, there needed to be the Golus Mitzrayim that prepared for that state. Why is that? Because the klipa, before it can be broken, has to be strongly weakened. The unholy shell that is blocking had to be softened for godliness, or had to go through some kind of a refinement so that godliness should eventually be able to break through it. And the exile, the Egyptian exile, was that softening of the klipa so that eventually the kedusha can penetrate and permeate the world. How was that? So that was also twofold. The first of it came about through the suffering of the Jewish people, because the Jewish people are the heart of creation. And just like in creation there is an intrinsic godliness, and then there is a klipa that is covering, so too within the Jew, there is also a neshama, which is an extension of divinity, as we had mentioned in so many other classes. And then there is an ego, there is an animal soul and a body and an ego that blocks, and a yetzahara that blocks and conceals and covers over the godliness. As a result, however, of the backbreaking labor, of the slavery, of the suffering, of all the brutality and persecutions that the Jewish people had endured when they were in Egypt, their ego was broken. And as their sense of I, sense of beingness, and arrogance that comes from the unholiness, from the animal soul, as that gave away because of the enslavement that they were through, that caused a weakening in the unholiness of all of creation, that it shouldn't serve that as such a barrier between Hashem and the world. That's number one. But even a greater factor wasn't the Galus Mitzrayim, but Yetzias Mitzrayim, was when God performed the amazing miracles, when he took the Yidden out of Mitzrayim. Though by the time of the Exodus, God made a mockery of the forces of nature. He turned nature upside down, inside out, displaying that the natural forces are really meaningless and they have no strength and no power at all. That display of godliness is what eliminated so much of the darkness, so much of the klipa, allowing for the next stage of the creation to reach its sublimation. Because the greatest force of concealment is the illusion that the world is run by a certain system of laws and scientific laws, which are the foundation of the way of things the way they are. And that's just an illusion. That's a cover-up on the consistent miracles and the fact that God is running the world. So Mitzrayim was a place that worshipped nature. They were the seat of science of that time. And when God toyed with the world, when he manipulated the world, the natural phenomenon, the natural elements within the creation, that broke the klipa and thereby allowed for the great revelation of Matan Torah. So that is the way that Golus Mitzrayim precedes and enables the Torah to be given as one explanation of how the Egyptian exile was a prerequisite to the giving of the Torah. However, there is another element, and this one is pertaining to the Jewish people, and the amazing effect that the giving of the Torah, an impact that the giving of the Torah had on them. To the Jewish people, Matan Torah is much more than that. Not only enabling a connection to Hashem, but Matan Torah was what connected every single Jew, man and woman, to be able to be, and wired them up, to be able to be expressors and conduits of godliness in this world. Meaning not only that the rest of creation should recognize God as their master and be in submission to Hashem, the Jew becomes a direct channel, conveyor, and conduit for godliness. And this is expressed at the very opening verse of Matan Torah, when Hashem said, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am God, your God. Hashem wasn't only introducing himself and saying, hey everyone, here I am God, nice to meet you, and you are so-and-so. That's not what the meaning is. It has a much deeper meaning to that. Anochi Hashem Elokecha means, I am God. Elokecha means I am your power. I am your strength. The word Elokim comes from the word strength and power. Elei Ha'aretz. When we say the name Elohim, we're supposed to have in mind that Hashem, as it says in Shulchan Aruch, that Hashem is a shalit. Hashem is a ruler. He has dominion over creation. Anochi Hashem Elokecha means I am God, your power. That means the power of your life is not you. It's not just a little tiny mortal human being. The power in your life, the strength, what is being expressed through your life, is the power of an infinite, endless, and God coming through each and every one of us. What does that mean? Just in simple words, something like this. When a Jew today gives tzedakah, puts a few coins in a charity box, in a tzedakah box, what is happening at that moment? It's not just the person who is expressing their generosity, their kind-heartedness. That would be a human act. What's really happening is that God's infinite kindness, his attribute of chesed, that is endless, is now taking form and being funneled and expressed through this act of charity. Meaning it's not you being kind, it's Hashem being kind through you. Which means the way it would work is that God's kindness is now being channeled through your soul into your heart, into your attribute, and through your attribute, via your attribute of kindness, from there into your body, into the muscles of your hand, all the way down to the fingers that are putting that coin into the charity box or writing the check that you're giving for tzedakah. This is a moment of expressed divinity in this world. God is now open and manifest. He is open and manifest in the same conspicuous way, in the same manner in which he was when the Torah was given and Hashem's voice was thundering throughout creation. In a small way, but in your life, Hashem is now coming through your body. And the same is also when you're speaking words of Torah, doing any mitzvah, but speaking words of Torah. It's not that you're quoting holy words. You're quoting the pasuk. Hashem said this way back then, 3,500 years ago. And Moshe Rabbeinu taught what he heard from Hashem, and we're saying it. When we're learning Torah, it's literally that Hashem is speaking through your soul, and he's speaking through your mouth. As it says, Va'asim devarai b'picha. I am putting my words into your mouth. The person is speaking godliness, an infinite expression coming through a finite vessel. But the finite vessel is not restricting it. It's not diminishing it. God is Elokecha, your power. And it's in all the activities, all holy activity in which we're doing, we're transcending the limitations of a finite, limited creature, and we're becoming a channel and a conduit for divinity. In truth, in a more concealed and hidden way, by the giving of the Torah, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Hashem himself became the power of every Jew, not only in the realm of Torah and mitzvahs, but really in every aspect of our life. Every single thing we're doing, even what seems to be mundane and seems to be ordinary like everyone else, again, over here it's not as revealed and as expressed, but the MS is, Hashem has become the power of each and every single one of us. And this is unrelated, doesn't make a difference to the level of spirituality, the level of observance of where a person is holding. A Jew is a conduit and an expressor through which Hashem. Now we did mention in earlier classes that really that's already began in the days of the Avos, Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, and that's what a Jew is all about, to be a lamp of godliness in this world, a Ner Hashem in this world. However, until Matan Torah, it was expressed and revealed in Avram, Yitzhak, in the patriarchs and the matriarchs, but not in their children. As we're going to see soon, they were of a lesser quality of soul on a lower level. But by Matan Torah, it became the actualized in every single one of us, especially when we are doing mitzvahs and we are studying Torah, that we are not ourselves, but we are expressors of the divine. And that is awesome. That is unbelievable. Because to think of that, even if we were to say that about a great tzaddik, the greatest Rosh Hashiva, or the great Rebbe, a great tzaddik in the world, and we say that, you know, we say how holy he is and how special he is, and that the holiness is shining, and that everything he does is with such purity. And but if someone would come and say, well, what he is doing, that there is divinity there, it's godly, you say, ach, come on, how can you say that? But in Hasidism, it says that yes, that's what it is. That this tzaddik, this great man, when he is doing a mitzvah, or when he is, it's not himself that is coming through, it is God that is coming through. So it's a chiddush even if we say it about a great tzaddik. And if we say it about even a tzaddik of the previous generations, tzaddikim like the previous Belzer Rebbe, who is known as an unbelievable miracle worker. Okay, he's a tzaddik, but godly? Or the Chafetz Chaim? Or even if we'd go back to the Chamsam Sofer, Rabbi Akiva Eger, the Holy Baal Shem Tov, Rabbi Akiva, or the Rambam and Rashi, or even the greatest, to say godly? How can you say godly? And here, in truth, it's not only them. It's every single person, even the most simplest of Jews, even someone who is totally ignorant, and even a lowly human being, even a sinner in Israel, even someone whose life is so materialistic, so earthy, has nothing to do with spirituality, even someone who's living a life antithetical to godliness. When a Jew does a mitzvah, even if the person is someone who never did a mitzvah all their life, even if it's someone who is covered in tattoos from head to toe, and you stop this person, and you do a mitzvah with them, or you study Torah with them, at the moment that they're studying Torah, Anoichi Hashem Elokecha, Hashem is vividly expressing itself through their hands and through their feet. This is utterly divine. This is unbelievable. That's the power of the giving of the Torah. This itself is such an energizer. This itself is so awesome. It's enough for a person to stop, if you're driving when you're listening to this, stop the car and pull off to the side of the road and sing and dance. Because we're not talking about something that happened yesterday, tomorrow. Today in the morning, if you were in shul and you put a money in, you gave a coin to tzedakah, you studied a mishnah, you did a mitzvah, at that moment you were not you. At that moment you were a channel for the infinite. This is incredible. But in order for that to happen, for such a magnificent thing to actualize itself, there needed to be some serious groundwork laid and preparation to be able to achieve this. Because really what is really happening is that Hashem, the infinite one, transcends and is above and isn't expressed in the creation, because he transcends the creation. When a yid is, as we're saying, doing a mitzvah, it means that the infinite transcendental light of Hashem is traveling from its distant state of transcending all of the universe and finding expression in a physical organ, in a physical limb of a physical human being down here in this planet, in this world. But what that means is that God has to travel, his light has to travel and bypass all now, as we know in Kabbalah, in Kabbalistic writings, and in Hasidus, that there are myriads and myriads and myriads of worlds, myriads of and each world inhabits trillions of creatures, spiritual beings, beings of light, beings of intense spiritual capacity, higher and higher and higher and higher. But as great as they are, they're creations. They're not God. But when, as a result of Matan Torah, a channel had to be opened up from God himself to find expression in our lowest, in our low world, and not only in tzaddikim, but in people whose lives are very, very much earthy, very, very much part of the unholy, and nevertheless, through them, Hashem should reveal itself. For that, a road has to be paved. A mitzvah, by the way, is called Derech Hashem, the Shamru Derech Hashem. Why is a mitzvah called Derech Hashem? Because just like a road is where a person travels on, so Derech Hashem means the place where God travels. When we are doing a mitzvah, as we mentioned earlier, like a mitzvah of tzedakah, then Hashem is traveling a road. Which road? From his infinite transcendental state, he is traveling through, bypassing all the myriads of worlds, lower and lower and lower, until he enters into your particular neshama, into your, not only your neshama, but into your body, into your hands, and down to your fingers. That's a road, an infinite road. But that road needed to be built. A road that can connect such extreme distance. That's the whole meaning of a road. It connects point A to point Z. Those roads needed to be built. Who built those roads? You know, when I was a child, I used to marvel at this, and I still marvel at it today, is when we travel and you go and you travel, you're driving somewhere and you're going on the freeways, and then you go off the freeways and you go into the road, especially into mountainous ranges, and there's roads and there's this road and there's that road and another road, and you wonder who built these roads. But someone built these roads. They were pioneers who laid miles and miles and miles of cement and carved them out the mountains to make these roads. Awesome. Someone built these roads. The great godly road of mitzvahs to be built, to be structured, a connection, had to have pioneering souls that would be those who would pave and open the channels of divinity to come from its pristine, transcendental, high estate and express itself in our lowly world that we are within today. And these roads had to, and the whole idea of that earlier generation, the generation of Yaakov, his sons, and the 70, and generally those that were in Mitzrayim, those Jews that lived pre-Matan Torah, was that they were, their main contribution was to bore a passageway through the layers and layers of darkness, and their passageway had to reach even the lowest and most distant, remote place, so that if a Jew who is in that darkness, today's days, a Jew who's living miles and miles away from the land of Israel, both physically, geographically, and mentally and spiritually, a Jew who's living in Zimbabwe, Jews who live in, whether it's in San Francisco, Paris, or in Hollywood, who are living in Hollywood, meaning they're impacted by the worldliness or unholiness of whatever this represents, and nevertheless, godliness should be able to reach them and express itself through their acts of a mitzvah. For that reason, there was an exile, the Gullus Mitzrayim. How is the Gullus Mitzrayim the preparation? And how did those generations build these roads through the Gullus? So the first thing that was necessary was really two components. The first thing that was necessary was that there had to be a drastic compromising or downsizing or down diminishment of the neshamas itself, which expressed itself in three generations. There was the first generation of Jews, which the first generation of Jews is really referring to the era of the patriarchs. Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov and the four matriarchs, they represent the first generation, even though they're three generations, but it's all part of one dimension. Then there is the second dimension, and that is a far inferior and diminished, spiritually diminished level, which is the 12 tribes, the Shvatim, the sons of Yaakov. And then, even lower than that, were the 70 souls, the 70 Jews, the family of of Yaakov that came down to Mitzrayim. Now, of course, the tribes are also part of the 70, but them as being part of the 70 is representing even a lower level of neshama. And what do we mean by that? A lower level of soul. So we had discussed in In the earlier classes, we had discussed that really all neshamas and all souls originate in the same place. We are all in our origins. We all come from, we all begin as a chelik lekayim imal, as a little piece of God from above. We emanate and we originate in the divine wisdom, in Hashem's brain, anthropomorphically speaking, in the mind of Hashem. That's where all Jews, the Jewish soul, begins. And over there, that point is a point of indivisibility that you can't break, you can't separate. And over there, all Jews are absolutely the same. There isn't a difference between the highest neshama and the lowest soul. There's no higher and there is no lower, because everybody is one and the same, because we're in a level of divinity of Hashem's very self that cannot be splintered into pieces. However, that's the quintessential origins of the soul. But then there are differences in neshamas, and that is in soul manifestation. As the souls emerge into a state of beingness, other, so to speak, other than Hashem, as they're emerging into the world, that's when there is a great difference in gradations of neshamas. There are the very, very lofty souls, godly souls, which are the souls of the great, great tzaddikim, super tzaddikim. And then there are other great neshamas, maybe not as great as those godly tzaddikim. And then there are levels and levels and levels and levels. And then we have the souls of generally of our generations, which are considered the souls of the heel, of Ikvas of the Mashiach, of the heel, the very, very, very bottom of neshamas. The difference between the neshamas is in their capacity to experience divinity, their capacity to experience godliness. Souls that are of a higher place have a greater capacity, and souls that are of a lower neshama have a lower capacity, which means the differences between people is not only, you know, how hard a person works. Of course, that makes a very big difference in our life. But really, there is a great difference in quality of neshamas, higher souls and lower souls. So we can divide the souls really into four gradations. If we divide them into separate levels, there is, why four? Corresponding to the four worlds. There is a world called Olam Atzilus, the world of, the Kabbalists speak of four levels of existence. There is a world of Olam Atzilus, the world of emanation. Then there is Olam Abriya, the world of creation. Then there is Olam Yetzira, the world of formation. And then there is Olam Asiya, the world of action. So to understand, I mean, this itself can take classes and classes to study and to gain an understanding and appreciation of what these mean. And even then, we know nothing. But Olam Asiya, just in simple, is our physical world that we live in, and it's the lowest because it's the most detached from God. As explained earlier, that the physical world that is operating with under the cloud of nature, under the disguise of nature, over here is where we can live in a state of ignoring and disregarding Hashem completely. That's our physical world. Here is where sin is possible, because the very environment is conducive to forgetting God. Because that's the physical world. It's obscuring that Einoid Malvado, that there's really nothing but Hashem. Then there is a world higher than this, called Olam HaYetzirah. It's a world inhabited by angels. So it's a world where there is no Yetzer Hara, because it's a world where godliness is felt in a very strong way. It is sensed in every creature and every being in that world how it is rooted in God, and God is the source of its existence, and Hashem is completely in control of it, and that's why it's in a perpetual state of surrender to Hashem. So a sin acting opposite of God's will is unthinkable. It's impossible. If Hashem is the root and giving me life and beingness every second, and that's why I exist, how can I disregard my source? How can I disregard the channel that is giving me my very beingness? However, even though it is a world that is recognizing God, it's still semi-dark in the sense that there is ego there. The creatures have a beingness, have a sense of apartness. They are creations created by God. They're enthralled by Hashem. They mostly want to serve Hashem. They're surrendered to Hashem. But nevertheless, they still have a sense of beingness, of apartness. Then there is an even higher world, and that is called the world of Bria. Over there, there's almost no ego, because it's a world so sublime. And even angels cannot live in that world, because the purity and the light and the truth that is shining in that world wouldn't allow for the existence of an angel. Because the malachim too have somewhat of a, as we said earlier, they have an ego. A ego that is bent and surrendered to Hashem, but yet they have some kind of an eye. Over here, there is a very, 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 very subtle, minute, benign eye. There is an eye, because it's already called creation. A world where the separateness begins, but extremely, extremely subtle. And that's why it's a world of neshamas, bodiless souls. Generally inhabit that world because the consciousness of souls are much higher than the consciousness of angels. And there are very, very sublime angels that also live and are residents of that world. But those are the highest of the malachim. Above that world is what we call Olam HaAtzilus. Olam HaAtzilus is a world of emanation. Emanation meaning that in that state of existence, that state of affairs, there is nothing but Hashem. Emanation, meaning whatever exists is just an emanation of Hashem. It's nothing else. There is no sense of apartness whatsoever. Why is it called the world? Because it's Hashem is expressing himself through attributes. Hashem is really beyond all attributes, but in that state, there are the Eser Sefiros, the 10 attributes, which attributes are already some kind of a design, some kind of a form to the otherwise undefined, simple, infinite light of Hashem. And that is the consciousness of the world of Atzilus, a world of complete attachment to Hashem. Now, all neshamas originally emanate and begin in the world of Atzilus, which means neshamas are one with Hashem. Now, there are neshamas that are called neshamas of Atzilus, which means that these souls are souls that, notwithstanding the fact that their souls came down in a body, they passed through the worlds and were descended into a body, they retain that consciousness of Atzilus, which means that there is nothing but Hashem. And that is why these souls live in as conduits for God every moment, not only in essence, but in an expressed conscious state. They have no state of self at all. For instance, the Avos, our patriarchs, were on that level. That's why it says, Avos Heinen HaMerkava, they are the chariot. What does it mean, a chariot? They are vehicles for God. There wasn't any movement in their life. In the life of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and in the matriarchs, there wasn't any movement. It means there wasn't any movement of their muscles. They never moved any limb that was not for and triggered by Hashem's interest, but by their interest. They weren't capable of an ego. And it wasn't because they were overpowering themselves. They were fighting, because then how much can a person control? To have control 24 hours every second, and even when you're asleep? So it wasn't that they were overpowering. There was nothing to overpower, because their whole take, their sense of reality was the truth of God. And that's why, that's the only thing to express is Hashem, because there's nothing but Hashem. These are, again, souls of the patriarchs, and throughout the generations, Hashem plants tzaddikim in the world that are called neshamas of Atzilus, which means their souls have not been impacted by the descent, by coming into it. Then there are, most of the neshamas, that are changed and are affected. Meaning as the souls make their way down into this world, they are downgraded, they are diminished, and which means that their consciousness is diminished, which means that they feel themselves as a created entity. They're not living in the state of Einod Movado, there is none but God. They have a self, a very spiritual self, a very high self, the burning with love for Hashem and awe of God and fear of God, but nevertheless, they have a being. And how far are they from the neshamas of Atzilus? There is a quantum separation, an absolute disconnect, because to come from a state of godly to a state of creation is an absolute breakaway. So they are infinitely inferior to the other neshamas. And this, again, when we say inferior, we mean not in essence, we mean in expression and in experience. In essence, all souls are Atzilus souls, are really connected and expressions of the divine. But as the neshamas manifest and express themselves, there are neshamas of the world of Bria, and then there are neshamas that retain, live in a consciousness of Yetzira, and then finally there are neshamas that live in a consciousness of the world of Asiya, which means souls that are very dark. In the sense, dark is that the darkness of the world, the concealments, the blockages, nature and the like covers, blocks, they're very strongly impacted by the deception that there is other, that the world has its own, is run by laws that is outside of God's control and the like. And it's not only a matter of the Yetzer Hara, but it's even in their neshama that there is a darkening and a concealment that impacts even the neshama. Why did God downgrade the neshamas? Why couldn't he leave all the souls in their pure atzilistic estate? And the answer for that is that simple. Because the point of neshamas coming into this world is that they should convey godliness into the most ungodly environment, and even in that ungodly environment, they should bring Hashem and holiness into it. If a neshama is a neshama of the world of Atzilus, its brightness, its light is so strong that it can't enter the darkness. Even when it comes down into the world, it isn't dark, because the light of the soul shines away the darkness. The soul sees through all the veils, just like it's not dark to God. All the concealment, Hashem sees how there's nothing but Him, and even through all the difficulties and the challenges of exile and the like, it's only Him all along, and there really is no evil, because even evil in its essence is really also controlled and directed by Hashem, because Hashem is everything. So that's how Hashem sees it. To these souls, Hashem is also, they also experience Hashem as everything. So they can't sublimate the darkness because they can't enter into the darkness. The only way to enter into darkness is you have to be susceptible to the darkness. And for that, Hashem has to turn down the light. He has to dim the light of the neshamas. Now, the first three generations of Jewish people, those that went into the Egyptian exile, were representing the three levels of neshamas. As we said earlier, the patriarchs and the matriarchs, the avos and the imois, they were neshamas of Atzilus. Then the next generation of the Shvatim, they were neshamas of the world of Bria. And mystically, we're not going to get into that now, that the realm of Olam HaBriya, of the world of Bria, is connected to the number 12. There are the 12 beasts of the chariot, four, and then each four, and they all have three in them, so it comes out to 12. So the number 12 is associated with the first subtle stage of separation from Hashem, which is symbolized, which was the consciousness of the neshamas of the Shvatim. Then, the next generation, the 70, is already the neshamas representing and on a level of souls of not of the highest point of creation, which is Bria, but of the lowest point of creation, which is the world of Asiya. Why? Because the world of Asiya is, as we said earlier, dominated, or at least seemingly dominated, by the forces of nature. The forces of nature are run, the inner mechanics of nature are driven by the 70 ministering angels. So the souls being in a state of 70 souls is because they are affected by the darkness which comes from the 70 ministering angels, creating a facade as if nature has its own power. Now this is, so here's a very an amazing thing, that God on purpose diminished the neshamas of the first three generations in such a drastic way, because you wonder, you have to ask yourself a simple question. We know that there was Yeridas Adoris, there was a descent of generations. But here, like in every generation is less, we can't compare it to our fathers and especially pre-war, the Jews then were on so much of a higher level, and we had tzaddikim then on a much greater level and the like. So we know that every generation is becoming less and less. But incomparatively to those first three generations, here we have the grandparents, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, which are of such supreme holiness, and their grandchildren, and at least the fourth generation, are already people who became idol worshippers. They were hardly expressedly Jewish. The only thing that they retained was, as it says, the merit that they had was their emunah, and what they had was they didn't change their language, and they had some resemblance of Jewish identity. How did this happen so quickly that there should be such tzaddikim, such godly people, and suddenly people so susceptible to the unholiness of Egypt? To the point when it came time to redeem them, there was an accusation that said, these are serving idols, they're immoral and they're immoral. There was a comparison between the two. How can that be? And the answer is, in Golus Mitzrayim, in that those three generations, God intentionally diminished the power. Now, diminishing the power of the soul is not really creating a lesser soul. It means tying and bottling up or closing the valves of spirituality of the neshama, that the soul itself shouldn't experience the depth of its connection to God. And only a tiny little stream of godliness should be visible and experienceable by that soul. And the reason for that is, as mentioned earlier, this generation needed to pave the road for Anochi Hashem Elokecha, that a Jew in all times, even in the more and the farthest, most disconnected state from Hashem, should be able to do a mitzvah. And when he does a mitzvah, there is a road, a channeling of the infinite light of God being expressed through that mitzvah of that most distant Jew. So a road, and those who are building a road need the builders of a road have to be both in the origins, where the road begins, and they have to travel all the way to the very end of the road. So these Jews, of that, the pre-Matan Torah Jews, had to experience the experiences of the latter Jews of our generation, of those that are going to be the most disconnected from Hashem, which means neshamis of the world of Asiyah. So Hashem took those 70 first primary super souls in essence and decreased their spiritual capacity to such a degree that they should be in the darkness that we are in the last generations before Mashiach. But that wasn't enough. Just the diminishing and decreasing of the soul was not sufficient to prepare for the giving of the Torah, because after all, those 70 souls were living in the land of Israel. So they were still living in a holy environment. Being that in the future, until Mashiach comes, there are going to be Jews that are living out. Not only are they of a lesser quality of neshama, but they are living outside and distant and removed from the Holy Land and removed from any Jewish environment. People that have grown up in situations where they have never even seen another Jew, been disconnected, never went to shul, didn't have a bar mitzvah, never celebrate Yom Kippur, sitting and eating non-kosher food, being in a complete disconnected state. And nevertheless, this Jew too should be able to be a conduit when he or she does a mitzvah for Hashem. It wasn't enough just to diminish the neshamas, but those souls had to be put into a crushing darkness, into a darkness of Mitzrayim. The darkness of Mitzrayim was the greatest exile, the darkest possible, similar to the darkness that we live right pre-dawn, pre-Mashiach. And they were experiencing this concealment, this great darkness, because Mitzrayim was a place steeped in immorality, a place of a culture that worshipped nature, a culture that was full of witchcraft and sorcery and magic and all kinds of any kind of depravement and unholiness. And the Jews went through that darkness. And the point of it was the pioneering road builders, road pavers, that would pave the road for divinity to reach even those very far crevices of existence, dark, dark cracks of the world. And how did they do that? Where did the godliness reach? Okay, we understand the darkness that they went through. But where was the godliness revealed in that unholiness? The godliness was revealed in their emunah, in their faith. It says that when God sent Moshe Rabbeinu to take the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim, Moshe Rabbeinu said, "V'hein lo yominu li," they won't believe in me, my words. And God says, how do you say something so terrible about my children? My children are maminim b'nei maminim. My children are believers, the children of believers. Which means that the Jewish people kept their faith alive. And when Moshe Rabbeinu came to them, they did. Vayamin, the people believed in him. Now, how did they believe? How did they believe in a God when they went through such inexplicable suffering and pain? When God hid himself from them, hid his face, and seemingly abandoned them, when they were so disconnected. And they as we said earlier, their hearts were numb, their minds were confused. Their neshama, their capacity, their sensitivity to Hashem was completely, completely diminished. That they didn't feel anything. They were in such an eclipse, such horrific darkness, and had all the reason to believe that they will never, ever get out of Egypt. There was never a servant, even one servant, that left Egypt. Egypt had such border control that it was impossible to leave. And they were slaves, similarly with a slave mentality. Them, their fathers, their grandparents, were 4 generations of servitude. Nevertheless, they kept their emunah, their faith alive. What was that emunah? That emunah is not them. That emunah is their spark of divinity that's in their neshama. The emunah is the depth of the Jewish soul to be able to be in a state. And when we say it's not a state where you see, where you understand. You absolutely don't understand. You're absolutely vulnerable to the darkness. You don't understand. You have questions. You have doubts. You're in pain. You're suffering. But in the midst of the suffering, you know that the suffering is going to come to an end. You know that Hashem is going to take you out. That this is not going to stay forever and ever. An end is going to come to this. There is an end to darkness. That faith, that emunah that they had, that was the way they built the road. Because even in the most extreme disconnected state, Hashem appeared. Hashem appeared in their emunah. And so now, in the future generations, after the Torah will be given, we don't have to go through the same experiences and work, and the difficult work of emunah. To us, it's already embedded in our neshamas. To us, it's there. And the instant we do a mitzvah, we have there is already a channel, there is already a pipeline open that Hashem should reveal himself in a human being that is otherwise the most disconnected and severed, and seemingly severed from Hashem. This was the accomplishment of Golus Mitzrayim as it prepared the world for Matan Torah. Now we'll understand the reason why there was a 69 members. We said, again, the number 70 we understand. There needs to be 70 representing the dimension of Olam Asiya, of soul consciousness that is in the world of Asiya, which is a consciousness where is very, very dark. But nevertheless, the 70th one was a mystery. The 70th one, as we said earlier, was either Yaakov, either Hashem was the 70th one, or it was Yocheved. And the reason for that is as follows. See, when Hashem is putting the Jewish people into such extreme darkness, there is always a very big risk at hand. You're putting a soul, you're counting that the soul, that the spark of truth, the spark of God that's within it, will withstand and will have the strength and endurance to be able to withstand all the pressures and all the difficulties of the exile. But how do you know? Maybe the waves, the crashing waves of darkness, will extinguish the neshama. Especially since, as we said earlier, it's not the neshama in its pristine state. It's the soul, as the soul has been already so, where the soul's hands or powers have been tied behind its back. The soul is restricted to even, it can't even unleash its powers, its strength. It's because of what Hashem has done to these neshamas to enable them to be in the exile. So there's always the power, chas v'shalom, of the soul being extinguished. So in order for Hashem to assure that the souls were not, God forbid, be overpowered and overwhelmed completely by the exile, Hashem, there had to be someone who was going to join the 70, someone who is above and beyond the exile, to give the power to those that are in the exile not to falter and not to fall, not to stumble. And that is why, the one opinion says, who is the one that was going to keep the Jewish people above and safe in the exile? So the first opinion is that it's Yaakov. As we said earlier, the patriarchs were beyond the exile. They to them, they were in a state where there's nothing that can possibly cover on Hashem. And by Yaakov Avinu coming down with them in the Golus, he empowered those that are going to be in the darkness to have the strength and not be broken completely by the Golus. So it was a mystical strength that was given from Yaakov. We see literally that Yaakov was beyond the exile, because when Yaakov came down to Mitzrayim, the exile couldn't start. We know that as long as Yaakov was there, the land of Israel was like the land of Mitzrayim was like the land of Eretz Yisrael. It was a land full of where spirituality and holiness was flourishing. because Yaakov blows away the exile. So even after Yaakov passed away, the fact that he entered with them into Galus, which means his soul was present with them, giving them the strength to be able to be in the darkness, but yet remain above and not destroyed by it. Another opinion comes along and says, well, no, it can't be Yaakov. Because had it been Yaakov, then it would have defeated the whole purpose of the Galus. Being that Yaakov is above, is a power above the darkness, if Yaakov is with them in the Galus, he himself would blow the cover of the exile. Just like to Yaakov itself, there can't be a darkness. He would be contributing that clarity, that light, to the other Jews, to the other people, and therefore they too would see through the darkness, so it wouldn't then, and then they couldn't be the ones preparing for the future generations, for people that will be in darkness to be able to experience godliness in the darkness, because they too would be above the Galus, above the darkness. So for that reason, Yaakov doesn't suffice. Who then, do they say? They say it's God. God came along. What do we mean? Well, that makes the question even stronger. If God, who is the ultimate transcendent one, if he is going to be with them in the Galus, then for sure there isn't going to be able to be an external darkness with a power within to overpower it, because there's no external darkness in the first place. So, but the answer is, God is so transcendent that he is able to be within but remain completely anonymous and completely invisible. See, the beauty and the greatness of the others were that they were recipients of Hashem's light, meaning they, in them, God was fully revealed. Since the definition of who they were beings of complete transparency and open towards Hashem, so they are entities of light. So their being is a contradiction to the darkness. When they come into the darkness, there is no darkness. But Hashem transcends even light. He transcends any revelation. It's the level of godliness that Kaddish Baruch Hu is generally associated with Kaddish, meaning removed, beyond, which in the Zohar is the level of godliness called Soviv Kalaman, which is higher than the world. It's present in the world, but yet remains completely above it. That power can be in the exile, but be completely above and higher of the exile. And so that's the power that gave the Jewish people the strength not to falter and not to be crushed by the Galus, but it remains completely anonymous. They don't know it, they don't feel it, and they don't sense it. But in a hidden, mysterious way, it's strengthening them and keeping them, chas v'shalom, from being destroyed. But then there is the third element, the third component. And the third opinion is that it's Yocheved, that little girl that was born. Because both Yaakov's contribution, and if we say it's Hashem's contribution, the contribution of them is not in the godliness that is revealed in the exile. It's only the protection that we should not be overwhelmed and destroyed by the exile. But there is but the main point, as we mentioned earlier, of the Galus itself was that we should be in the concealments and in the darkness, and yet the power of godliness, the power of Emunah, should shine and should give the strength for the person to endure and to believe that Hashem is going to take him out. That Emunah, that's the display of Hashem in this world, in the Galus. That power is associated dafka with Yocheved, this little girl that was born. Why? Because the power of Emunah is a feminine power. It originates in the feminine element of godliness. We mentioned already in earlier classes that there is two dimensions, general dimensions, in divine manifestation. One of them is a masculine level of godliness, which is generally associated with the level HaKadosh Baruch Hu, transcendental light. And then there is a level called Shechina. Shechina means indwelling light. It's the godly energy that invests itself within the creation. That's the feminine dimension of godliness, the root of Jewish women. Now, the Shechina has within itself, interestingly, a paradox. On the one hand, the Shechina is the most vulnerable to the concealment, because the Shechina lowers itself down into the world. That's why there's a concept of Galus HaShechina, of exile of the Shechina. And the Shechina, it says that Iragleha Yeredes Maves, her feet go down to death, because she is impacted by the world that she creates. By her, there is a concealment and a constriction. But on the other hand, Malchus and the Shechina is the source of Emunah. Because after all, it's God. And that's what, and because it's Hashem, that's why Emunah. because the Shekhinah is also connected to the attribute of Malchus, kingship. Kingship, it says, Malchuscha Malchus Kol Olamim. God is the king over the world, meaning he creates the world, and he creates it the way he wants it, that the world is covering and concealing him, but nevertheless, he's the king over it. And that's Emunah. Emunah is, even when it looks like everything is tipsy-turvy, everything seems to be going against holiness, and against everything is working against me, I know that that too is God, even though I don't understand it. Because of what? That energy is coming from the Shekhinah, who dominates over creation, is within the creation, shrouded, enclosed, covered by the creation, yet is controlling creation. That's why Malchus is called the Emunah, which is one of the names of the Shekhinah. As we say, the Emunah called Zos. Mystically, Zos is referring to the Shekhinah, and the Emunah, Malchus is called Emunah. The Emunascha Balelos. When do you need Emunah? When it's dark, when there's concealment, when we don't understand. That's when we need Emunah. When it's bright, we don't need Emunah. In the time of darkness, that's why we say it by evening service, by Ma'ariv, the Emunah kolzos, because now is when we tap into the power of the Shekhinah that is within our soul. That last and final contribution was represented by the 70th one, which was a little girl, Yocheved, that was born. When she was born at the entrance of Mitzrayim, here's where you see in her life too, first of all, the fact that she was a girl that needed to be the 70th one, because this was the Shekhinah entering with them, to empower them to have Emunah, despite the fact that they would be so impacted by the dark and the concealments of the exile. But here is where you see the interesting thing about Yocheved. On the one hand, out of all the 70, she suffered the most, because the other 69 Jews died earlier, besides, again, the one woman, Serach. All the other ones, because it says that the main difficulty of the labor did not begin until that first, all the 70 passed away. The only one that survived, that lived through the hardship, the most difficult and agonizing time of the exile, was Yocheved. So she suffered the most. She went into the darkness, experienced the darkness. But at the same time, she was the mother of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu is the one who is the redeemer of the Jewish people. Moshe Rabbeinu is the one who reveals the Emunah. Because when he came, he brought out the Emunah amongst them. They all believed in him. And she, Yocheved itself, was the one who brought out the Emunah when she acted as a midwife and encouraged the Jewish women to disregard Paro's decree and keep on having children. She was the source of Emunah, because Yocheved was this conduit of the Shekhinah in the Gullus, the mother of Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's why she had to be the 70th one. B'schus ha'amunah, the Jews went out of Mitzrayim. It's that schus which was the whole purpose of the Gullus. That in the darkness, as you experience the pain and the suffering, you don't give up, because you know that God is with you, and that Hashem, that holiness and godliness will prevail. And that one day we will come out of this. That's the power. And that's where we find that in general, that emunah is stronger by women than it is by men, because it is a feminine trait. This is also an explanation, we said in the beginning, why the Torah uses a feminine term for explaining who the 70 people that went down into Egypt, not a masculine term, because the main contribution of the Jews as they were in exile was to have Emunah even when it was dark. And that's why they were like 70 women when they went down to Mitzrayim. They weren't men. They were men, but they were men with the feminine trait of Emunah, of strength. And the lesson of all of this, and the final lesson that we can take out of this, is first of all to understand the preciousness of every Jewish child. And the little baby that is born, when you have a child, a little girl, a little boy, so much godliness has now been inserted and invested in your life. Understand that this is a soul, a godly soul that entered into your life. So that's one thing. A little baby, maybe no one would have paid attention. She was born, everybody was busy then, coming through the borders. But even a much deeper lesson, and a very, very important for us and our generation. Because, you know, we are going through extreme periods of darkness. And we don't know. We don't understand why Hashem puts us through such concealments. But from the story of Mitzrayim, we see that it's not your fault, it's not our fault, that we have such a minute spiritual capacity. Of course, we would all love to be in a state where we see Hashem all the time, and when we're burning with a passion and love for Hashem, and all we want to do is mitzvahs. But it could very, very well be that the purpose of your life is dafka being realized as a human being who suffers, who experiences that the gullus has a gripping effect on you, the exile is a gripping, the unholiness is a gripping. You feel temptations, desires, wants. You might even be a person who's suffering from deep addictions. It can be people that we have a deep and powerful addiction, and we think, gewalt, like, what's the point of my life? I keep on struggling and struggling. Who knows? it's possible that the very emuna and faith of not giving up and knowing that you will come out of it, in that itself, you're fulfilling the purpose of your soul in this world. As much as it's painful, you don't understand how come you have to be in this spot. That's what they needed to be, and they might have not have known. But that was the purpose of it. They should be in the darkness, suffer, not above it, but in that darkness, know that Hashem will take them out. The fact that we don't give up, and more, a person could be even in a state where they do give up. But nevertheless, there are bursts of emunah, bursts of faith, and who knows if that's the whole purpose of your existence and life, and that's how you're making this world godly, is that you have ended up in such a dark crevice of creation where there is no godly light, and nevertheless you have your emunah. This is a display of Hashem's light in your life. So don't take credit for your faults, and don't take credit for your darkness. We shouldn't take credit for our merits, but even the darkness of our life, Hashem puts us into these places. We have to try and seek to get out of it, but we have to have the comfort and the understanding and knowing that this is purposeful. Same is also when we deal with children that are at risk, or children that are going off to some families. These children too, there is a purpose to this. It's not just an accident. They too have a purpose. There's a reason for their life. There's a reason for the darkness they go through. And it's a very, 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 and there's a godly reason for that. And we need to cherish them and understand their struggles and understand that too has a purpose and a meaning. Yaakov also, I'm sure, looked at three generations down and said, these are my children, ugh. So when you're dealing in your life and you find yourself in a state of finding so much ech and fech in your life, understand that there is a reason, and that it's quite possible. You know, it's the struggle itself, and it's the keeping yourself breathing every day and above it and fighting with it. That itself is the greatest godliness and the greatest contribution. So may Hashem help that all darkness should dissipate, and we should all experience the ultimate light, the light of the coming of Mashiach. Take it instantly. My head, I heard a new song, the song.